jealous for hunger. For once, Gareth didn't smile, leaving Rhone to wonder whether he was joking. He suspected not. If convicted as a spy, the king would have no choice but to have him executed. But the threat of death had been Rhone's companion for some time, and he did not fear it the way he used to. He swallowed the thought away, and went back to gazing around the marketplace. Though the non-meat food was of significant interest to him, the metal workers were what stole most of his attention. They reminded him of Gwendolyn, with their angled faces and strange attire. Each of them were covered from head to toe in metal, which seemed to mould to their bodies, regardless of height, weight, or shape. He'd never seen craftsmanship the likes of what they sold. There were swords that should have been on display rather than used as weapons. Shields so pristine they appeared as precious as gemstones shimmering in the daylight. And armour fit for royalty hanging on stands meant to attract normal people. They stopped at one such stand, and Gwendolyn hailed the owner. A man emerged. Well, Rhone thought it was a man, but it was hard to tell. His skin was rough and bark-like, almost like that of a tree. Not just his hands, which ended in stumpy fingers, but the rest of him too. His face flat and grotesque, his eyes as black as briskets of coal in sunken craters of mottled flesh. There were only three or four spots of pink flesh poking through, including one atop his hairless brown scalp. "Bark," Gwendolyn said, flashing a smile so lovely that Rhone knew it was her real smile, not the fake one she'd offered him earlier, just before she knocked him flat on his back. They embraced, and it looked as unusual as if she'd hugged a tree.
"How were your travels, my hero?"
the man, Bark, asked.
"You've had adventures, I trust."
His voice was a watery gurgle, and Rhone had to concentrate to understand him. "Plenty. I'll tell you all about them soon enough. But first, business. The three princes require new armour and a dozen new weapons. Cost is no issue."
"Of course. For you, anything,"
the prince said. "And for me?"
"I'd do it for her, not you,"
Bark said. The prince chuckled and mouthed, "Beguiled," to Rhone. Rhone shook his head. Insulting royalty in Calypso would earn you a quick trip to the fighting pits if you were lucky. If you weren't so fortunate, you'd be given the opportunity to have your head separated from your neck. "Meet me at the Iron Gates once you've concluded business this evening," Gwendolyn went on. "We'll work out the details."
"As you wish, my hero,"
Bark said, kissing her hand with lips that must have been as rough as the backside of stone. She cupped his cheek for a moment and then mounted up, leading them further into the city. As they trotted along, she targeted Rhone with a sly smile and a devilish look. "Bark, huh?" Rhone said to Gareth. "She's always treated him better than the rest of us." "Why?"
"Maybe because he is better," the prince said, his lip curling.
Something Bark said to Gwendolyn occurred to Rhone. "He called her his hero. Is that supposed to be a question? He said it twice. Why?"
"You think too much," the prince said.
Rhone daydreamed of the tethers breaking from his hands so he could knock the smile off the prince's beautiful lips. Maybe his intentions were written all over his face, because his thoughts only made the prince smile broader.
"You're as sensitive as an unflowered maiden," Gareth said.
"I meant no offence, only that sometimes the answer is all too obvious." Rhone thought about it, realizing his stupidity. "She saved Bark's life." Gareth nodded. "Once. Now he would retrieve both of the moons for her, if she asked." "What did she do?" The prince waved away the question.
"Ask him. Or better yet, ask her. That would prove immensely amusing. Now cease with your incessant questions. The Iron Gate approaches."
Rhone turned his attention forward, where a metal wall near as tall as the dragons of Plague Island stood, constructed between natural tree pillars. The metal seemed liquid, rippling just beneath the surface, its face in constant motion. An enormous iron gate bearing the royal sigil blocked the way forward, protected by a retinue of royal guardsmen. Each man must have stood 7 feet tall, because even on his toes, Rome knew he'd have to angle his head to look any of them in the eye. Standing shoulder to shoulder in full battle armor, they almost looked like a miniature version of the wall they protected. In the dead center of their formation was an even larger man, who wore a pendant on a long, linked chain around his neck. Roan squinted, and was able to make out the design of an armored fist. "They say he's descended from the mountain men of the north," Gareth said. "Who?" "Bjorn Stonesledge. The giant you're staring at. By the way, he doesn't like when people stare at him, especially strangers." Roan realized the massive guardsman's eyes were narrowed, and he was looking right back at him. Roan averted his eyes, pretending to study a speck of dirt on his boot. The prince chortled loudly. "What is that symbol he bears?" Roan asked. "The one around his neck." "The iron mark," Gareth said. "It's an imitation of his skin mark. I've seen him use it, too. His foes would have been better off facing one of those dragons you claim to have survived." It took all of Roan's strength to keep his expression neutral. "Another tattooer?" And again, like Gwendolyn Storm, this man wore his openly, without fear, dangling the symbol of his power around his neck. The very concept was foreign to him. "Remind me never to challenge him to a grapple, then," Roan said, trying to make light of the situation. "I doubt if you'll ever get the chance anyway," the prince said, once more dancing his horse away and leaving Roan to ponder the subtle threat. The guardsmen cleared a path for the prince and his men, while Gwendolyn dropped back to escort Roan through the arched gates, which seemed to liquefy and flow into the walls on either side. Inside was a huge courtyard, which curved away in both directions. As soon as the royal convoy was inside, liquid ore poured out from either side of the wall and hardened back into the enormous iron doors. Roan blinked, amazed. "How does that work?" he asked. Gwen said, "My people channel the ore." "How?" She shrugged, managing to make even such a common gesture look graceful. "We just do. I can't explain it in a way you will understand. Ore channeling isn't something that can be learned. It's either in you or not." Without another word, she strode away, following the curve of the wall. Roan scanned his surroundings, which were abuzz with activity, not unlike the rest of the city. To one side, troops wearing light armor were being trained in hand-to-hand combat, while another platoon was engaged in target practice, the twang of their bows punctuated by satisfying thwacks as their arrows entered straw dummies. On the opposite side, horses were being watered, rubbed down, and fed. The most interesting thing about the courtyard, however, was that not a single tree had been felled to construct it. Instead, fixtures had been built amongst the nature, almost allowing the forest to guide the construction. A group of men and women paused in their duties to tend to the prince's horses as they dismounted. "Thank you," Gareth said, handing over his reins. "This is some setup you have here," Roan said. "This is nothing," Gareth said, raising his arms over his head so a soldier woman could remove his chestplate. Soon he was wearing only a green shirt, brown breeches, and his boots. For a moment, Roan wondered what he looked like beneath the fabric. He shook away the thought. "This man, regardless of how handsome, wants to see you executed," he reminded himself. "Wait until you see the rest," Gareth continued. There was something in the prince's eyes that gave Roan pause. Something clicked. A truth he'd been missing from the moment they entered Ironwood. They hadn't blindfolded him once during the trip. They were allowing him to see everything, including the inside of the castle. If they truly believed he was a spy, they wouldn't be so careless unless... His heart skipped a beat. They were never going to let him leave. 7. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anise Garrick. A hush fell over the crowd. Anise knew her brother well enough to see the fear in his eyes, despite his attempt to hide it beneath a stalwart expression. As he walked past the royal box, they made eye contact, and she wanted to scream. Several commoners expressed their outrage at their beloved prince's situation, but were quickly silenced by the guards, doubling over after being hit in the gut. Sir Dietrich passed next, his face as calm as ever, like he was just taking a morning stroll, rather than being led to his execution. Both hands were bound, but intact, which meant the icy blue tendrils that had passed into him from the Ice Lord had only had a temporary effect. He even managed to offer her a grim smile. There were more protests amongst the rabble, this time for the melee champion. More guards moved amongst the crowd to maintain order.
"They can't do this," Anise thought.
They were empty words, she knew, as hollow as a rotted log. Her uncle could and would do whatever it took to assume power in the north now that her father was gone. And with the Ice Lord and the Royal Guardsman on his side, there was little anyone could do about it. The prisoners' footsteps were thunderous on the wooden planks, which creaked slightly under their trod. Guarded by three soldiers, Arch was forced at sword point up the steps to the same gallows his mother had just been cut down from. A fresh noose had been fitted and hung. Sir Dietrich was sent up to the second platform. The nooses were wrapped around each man's neck and tightened.
"No," Anise thought. "Not men. Arch is only 16. He can say he's a man grown, a king now, but he's still my little brother. And now..."
She couldn't finish the thought, her eyes burning, her lips beginning to tremble. She was gripping the railing so hard she thought her fingers might break off in the cold. Arch's breathing was rapid now, his exhalations a ghostly visage before his lips, which opened.
"This is a farce of a trial," he said,
his voice remarkably strong and clear. He spoke directly to the people, the commoners, the people who adored him. Where was the boy she saw a moment ago?
"My mother has just been murdered before your eyes. And now they seek to murder your rightful king and your most recent melee champion."
"The traitor speaks,"
Lord Griswold said.
"But your voice falls on ears that were loyal to your father. They are deaf to your pleas."
Despite his words, a handful of the commoners attempted to charge the platform. The king's defense formed a barrier, shoving them back. The commoners tried again, and this time the guardsmen used deadly force, killing a man and a woman before the remaining people quieted and backed away. Anise watched as the bodies were removed, too numb to feel anything. It was like her father had been reincarnated in the form of her brother, the reign of the dread king continuing seamlessly. For the northerners, this was just another day fraught with fear.
"My words shall be heard,"
Arch continued. Anise wanted to be proud of her brother's courage, but her stomach hurt too much.
"Without him, with my father's death, I became the King of the North, protector of Castle Hill and all who live north of the Mournful Mountains. You, my uncle, are the traitor, and I find you guilty."
Anise managed to pry her eyes away from Arch long enough to look at her uncle's reaction, which was filled with narrowly disguised venom. Spit froze on his lips as he spoke.
"You have been found guilty of treason against the very crown you pretend to support. And your so-called champion, Sir Dietrich, has disobeyed a direct order from a superior. Both of your crimes are punishable by death."
"No,"
several commoners screamed. But this time they were just words without action. Despite their protests, they were unwilling to risk their own lives.
"Am I?"
Anise wondered. There were guards at either elbow, gripping her tightly in the event she made a move to help her brother. She could fight them, surprise them with the strength she knew she had. But would it really help? The odds were stacked impossibly against her.
"Executioner!"
her uncle shouted.
"Mete out the punishment on these traitors."
The man in the black cloak stepped forward, assuming a position directly between the two gallows. His head swiveled back and forth, as if trying to decide who should go first. Did it really matter? He turned, then, away from the gallows, his shadowed face aimed at the royal box.
"Executioner! Do your duty!"
Anise's uncle shouted. The executioner threw back his hood to reveal a familiar mesh face mask, dark eyes staring out.
"The armored knight,"
Anise realized, a split second before the large man reached under his cloak and whipped out the chain attached to the spiked ball. The guards were too slow by half, the melee runner-up having already swung his weapon with vicious force. The barbed ball shredded the ropes over Arches and Sir Dietrich's heads, and they collapsed to the wooden platforms. But they didn't stop there, disappearing from sight as if they'd tumbled into a deep snowbank.
"What in frozen?"
Anise watched as the guards tried to apprehend the armored knight, but his spiked ball was a whirlwind of fury, smashing armor and splintering spears until the guards were forced to back off. Several of them dropped to a knee and shot arrows, but his armor held strong against the onslaught. Nearby, Anise's uncle was screaming something, ordering the king's defense to pursue the prisoners. Jonius and the other guardsmen in the box were clearly distracted.
"Be ready,"
Aunt Zelda had instructed. She was ready. For what, she didn't know. With a roar, the armored knight swept forward and bludgeoned two of the archers with a single swing of his chain. The rest fled. He turned and looked right at Anise, the man who'd kicked out the platform beneath her mother's feet, the man she'd chosen to win the melee, the man who'd killed her mother and saved her brother and Sir Dietrich. He extended a hand toward her, and she started to climb over the rail.
"Be ready."
Two guards grabbed her arms, and though she fought them with all the strength she had, they held firm. Something whizzed past her face. Then another something, and the pressure was gone from her skin. The guards thudded to the floor, arrows protruding from one's neck and the other's eye.
"Be ready."
Anise flung herself over the railing as Sir Jonius reached for her. His fingers clamped on the hem of her skirts, but her momentum was too much, the fabric tearing away.
She was free.
An arrow zipped past her ear, shot by one of the royal archers who'd retreated to a safer vantage point across the platform. He quickly knocked another arrow to his bowstring, pulled back, released. A dark form sprang in front of her, the arrow plunging into the gap between his gauntlet and vambrace. With a grunt, the armored knight scooped her up in one powerful arm and launched himself toward the gallows, clambering up the ladder and diving through a hatch that had opened in the platform floor. Anise tumbled into darkness, her ankle twisting as she landed awkwardly atop her rescuer, his armor clattering.
"Sister,"
Arch said from somewhere in the inky black.
"Allow me, princess," said the voice of Sir Dietrich.
Strong fingers grasped her beneath the arms and pulled her to her feet.
"He's injured,"
was all she could think of to say.
"The armored knight. An arrow struck him between his plates."
"I'm fine,"
the knight grunted, his armor clanking as he rose to his feet.
"We have to hurry. Go!"
Someone grabbed her hand and pulled her down a black corridor that reeked of filth. Wetness splashed around her legs with each step.
"What is this place?"
Anise asked, wishing she could see something, anything.
"The royal sewers,"
Arch answered enthusiastically, like they were off on a grand adventure.
"Zelda set the whole thing up. Who knew she was such a rebel?"
"Quiet,"
the armored knight hissed.
"We have company."
Even as he said it, Anise's ears picked up the sound of heavy boots landing in water. Shouts echoed behind them.
"We need light," Sir Dietrich said.
"No,"
the armored knight said.
"You need me. Now turn right. This way."
Anise was yanked to the right before she could even begin to consider how the knight could navigate in complete darkness. Somewhere behind her, a swathe of flickering light danced on the walls.
10 more steps, and then left,"
the armored knight instructed. Anise counted in her head, wondering whether she should add a few steps, because surely her strides were shorter than his. In the end, it didn't matter,
because Arch tugged her along behind him.
"Keep up, sister," he said.
Anise cursed. She was reasonably quick over short distances, but she had a feeling her stamina was about to be pushed to its limits. Her legs were already feeling heavy, and she was limp running because of the throbbing pain coursing through her ankle, radiating up her leg. 3 turns later, she could hardly breathe. She tried to say, "Stop," but it came out as a pant. With no other choice, she pried her fingers free of Arch's grip, doubling over and sucking in lungfuls of air. Arch cried out, and she could hear his boots splash to a stop. Anise was about to tell him to go on, that she would catch up after a quick rest, but a strong hand grabbed her arm and stifled the words in her throat.
"Going somewhere, princess,"
Sojourneus said, his breath hot on her face. He spoke calmly, his voice low.
"Please," she said. "You know me, don't you?"
The knight stiffened beside her.
"I know nothing," he said. "You cared once,"
Anise said, still breathing heavily.
"No one has to know. No one. You can come with us. You can be free."
"You don't know what you ask," Jonius said. There was sorrow in his tone. Regret.
"Please,"
Anise said again, placing her hand atop his.
"If you won't come, let us go."
One by one, she pried his fingers away. He let her, saying nothing.
"Thank you,"
she whispered as she pulled away.
"Save yourselves,"
the knight said.
"Go east. It's your only hope."
"Thank you,"
Arch echoed.
"For everything."
Once more he found Anise's hand and pulled her into the darkness. As the distance widened between them and Sojourneus, she heard more shouts, and then the faithful knight said,
"There's nothing but a dead end this way. We should go back and find another passage."
The sounds of their pursuers drifted away. The sky was grey and full of snowfall when, hours later, they finally pushed aside a barrier of dead foliage and emerged from the wet darkness of the sewers. A filthy creek burbled nearby, fed by the sewers and, in the summer, snowmelt. Anise blinked against the snow-reflected brightness as her eyes tried to adjust to daylight once more. Her legs were cramping, her lungs aching. But she was alive, and so was Arch, which was what mattered the most.
"We cannot linger here," Arch said. "They will know the sewers' tributaries. They'll be searching them all."
"Not this one," the armored knight said. "It was secret to all but the king and queen. A last resort in the event there was ever a coup, and they were sent to the gallows."
"Then how do you know about it?"
Anise said, glaring at the knight under the hand she was using to shield the light.
She didn't know this man. Yes, he saved them, but to what end? Where was he leading them?
"Your mother told me," he said.
"My mother,"
Anise said, her voice rising. Icy tendrils crept into her blood, but they had the opposite effect, heating her skin rather than chilling her.
"Don't you dare, Anise," Art said, cutting her off. "We don't have time for this. We have to keep moving."
"Arch, he killed—"
Her voice vanished in a sob, which arose so suddenly she couldn't stifle it.
"She's dead. Mother, he's dead."
"I know,"
he said, placing a gentle hand on her arm. Her anger faded and she shivered.
"She did it for us. It's what she wanted."
"No,"
Anise wanted to say, but she knew it was true. She remembered the way her mother had looked at her, at the way she'd said guilty, with such conviction and courage. It was the first time Anise had seen her mother look anything but angry or sad. It was the first time she'd looked truly alive.
"I'm sorry for your loss,"
the armored knight said. His voice was low and gravelly and sincere. Anise wondered how the man who had kicked out the platform could even begin to apologize for what he'd done,
stuff your rotting apology, Anise said. Just get us somewhere safe and warm.
She knew it was a rare moment when she sounded like a spoiled brat princess, but she didn't care. Her status was the only armor she had left against the weight of grief pressing on her chest. Heavy snow filled in their footprints as they trudged away from Castle Hill, which shone through the gale like a beacon in a storm. Despite her knee-high sheepskin boots, Anise couldn't feel her toes when they finally took shelter within a copse of pine trees. The fallen nettles made for a soft cushion, and she gladly settled onto them, pulling off her footwear, which was sheathed in frozen snow. Arch settled beside her, shucking off his own boots and massaging his feet. Sir Dietrich traipsed through the trees, collecting firewood, while the armored knight stood sentry, his eyes probing through the snowfall. The arrow was still protruding from his arm, but he showed no signs of being affected by it. His dark armor was slick with blood, which looked strangely black.
Arch,
Anise whispered, quiet enough that only her brother would be able to hear her.
We have to get away from these two. They will ransom us. They are strangers who have no other reason for risking their own lives to rescue us. They are Anise,
Arch said. Something struck her, so obvious now that she thought about it.
They knew each other the whole time,
she hissed.
They've been in league since before the melee. They've been planning this from the beginning. They're Anise,
Arch said again.
There's more to the story than you know. Aunt Zelda came to me. Me too,
Anise said, frustrated.
She spoke of Mother.
Anise managed to get the last word out, barely.
Yes,
Arch agreed.
There were more layers to Mother than we ever knew.
Arch's gaze travelled down to his pale feet, and Anise followed it. A moment of silence stretched its wings, before flitting away like a snow moth.
She saved us,
Anise said.
But what about the arrows that helped free me? Where did the women loyal to Zelda?
Arch said. Anise blinked.
Women?
Women didn't train in archery. Even her own battling with the lordlings in the yard was looked down upon by the lords and ladies of the castle.
Yes. Zelda has been training them in secret for a long time.
All these years, her aunt had not been idle. Anise hoped she'd get the chance to thank her one day.
But it still didn't make sense. But why did Mother have to die? Couldn't she have dropped into the sewers like we did? Couldn't we all have escaped together? Couldn't we have...
Anise's words had come too fast, and she'd forgotten to breathe. She gasped, and Archie's arms closed around her. Her eyes burned with unshed tears, held back by anger alone.
No,
Arch said.
If she had escaped first, then we wouldn't have been able to.
Anise closed her eyes, feeling the truth of his words wash over him. She'd died so they could live. In the end, she had loved them more than herself, a thought which made Anise unbearably sad.
But how could...
The memory of the platform being kicked out by the armored knight, her mother's body dropping, and the struggle that ensued seared through her mind.
He have done such a thing.
She glared at the armored knight, wishing she could rip off his mask and smash her fist against his face again and again and again and again.
Because she asked him to,
Arch said, snapping the rope between her eyes and the knight. Sir Dietrich scattered a load of firewood before them, and began angling them upwards in a pyramid shape, meeting at the top in the center. Vapor rose from his skin as his body heat met the frigid air. He never seemed to tire or falter.
"I'll have you warm and toasty soon enough, Princess," he said, flashing a handsome smile.
Just his smile was enough to warm Anise's cheeks.
"Thank you, sir,"
she said.
"You can call me Dietrich,"
he said, using a flint repeatedly, trying to get a spark. He cupped his hand to block the wind as a bit of kindling began to smoke.
"I'm sure Castle Hill will be stripping me of my knighthood soon enough. Arm, too."
He gestured to the armored knight, who'd begun pacing along the edge of the tree line.
"Arm?"
Anise said, raising an eyebrow. The smoke turned to flame, creeping up the dry twigs and underbrush, orange and red fingers reaching for the firewood. "I've travelled with him for weeks, and still he won't tell me his true name," Dietrich said with a shrug. "The armoured knight is too long, not to mention pretentious, don't you think? So I just call him Arm." Anise was about to suggest something else less kind they could call him, but Dietrich cut her off. "If I may be so bold, Princess, Arm was only doing his duty, same as the rest of us. He didn't want to do what he did, but protecting you and the prince, rather I should say king, were his first priority. It was what your mother wanted."
"What do you know of my mother?" Anise said,
feeling the warmth of the crackling fire begin to seep into her skin and unfreeze her bones. "Not a lot. I mostly communicated with Lady Zelda. Arm could tell you more. He's known your mother since he was just a little lad." Anise stood, squirming out of Arch's grasp as he tried to stop her. She marched over to the armoured knight, who stopped his pacing when he noticed her presence. He was as still as stone, the only evidence of life the white ghosts of his breaths slipping through his mask.
"How do you know my mother?" she demanded.
"Your mother, the queen, knew my mother," he said, his voice a low growl.
He sounded dangerous, but Anise didn't care. If he'd wanted to hurt her, he could have let her get hit by the archer's arrow back on the platform. As easily as he'd participated in her mother's death, he'd saved Anise's life, a contradiction she was struggling to make sense of.
"How?"
The question hung in the air like a fine mist, and when Arm didn't answer, she stepped closer.
"Take off your mask."
"No,"
Arm said.
"Why not? Are you missing an eye? Do you have a growth on your chin? Are you the ugliest man in the Four Kingdoms? Whatever it is, I don't care about that. I just want to know why in frozen hell you killed my mother and then saved me and my brother."
Anise snarled the last words, her anger consuming her. When the armoured knight remained silent, her emotions boiled over, out of control. She launched herself at him, slamming her shoulder into his midsection, which was protected by thick iron, pummeling her coiled fists into his breastplate, which sent shockwaves through her hands. She didn't care about the pain or the futility of her attack. She just wanted to feel something different, something that might chase away the hurt and sadness. With the same skill she'd witnessed during the melee, the knight spun her around and subdued her furious arms. She tried a backwards kick, but he dodged it and eased her to the ground, his strength akin to that of a blacksmith's sledge. The armoured knight's mask hovered over her, a dark net that rumbled as he spoke. His eyes bored into her with an intensity matched only by the words that followed.
"I loved your mother like my own," he said.
There was something more than sadness in his tone. Something desperate, like a plea for her to hear the truth behind his declaration.
"What I did, I will never forgive myself for. My only hope for redemption is to protect her children. To protect you."
With that, he released her and stalked from the cover of the trees and into the storm. His footprints were dark with blood.
"Shouldn't we go after him?"
Anise asked. She was finally warm and dry, and was just finishing an apple. The apple was dessert. She'd already eaten a full serving of salted mutton, 2 dried pork shanks, and a half-frozen bread roll. Sir Dietrich stared at her the whole time, his mouth opened in awe. She stared right back, crunching into the apple and spraying juices into the fire, which sizzled and spat.
"Better not to poke a sleeping bear," Arch said.
"Don't fear, Princess. He'll return before we leave for Blackstone," Dietrich said.
"Blackstone?"
Anise said, still chewing.
"I thought we were going east. We could hide in one of the small towns near Walburg."
"We're not going to Blackstone," Arch said.
"Nor Walburg."
"But your mother said
Sir Dietrich started. "My mother isn't here," Art said, which finally vanquished Anise's appetite. "She saved us, but now we have to do what's right for the kingdom." "Exactly," Sir Dietrich said. "We need to hide you. Blackstone is the largest city in the north. There you can blend in, just another snowflake in the blizzard. And when you come of age, though you're big enough to have surpassed 30 name days, you're barely 2 years older than me, Dietrich. So don't act like a wise elder." "I don't care about age," Art said. "I am king. Not 2 years from now. Not tomorrow. Now. And I refuse to hide from my uncle or anyone else." Anise was prouder of her brother than she'd ever been, but that didn't change the fact that they needed to go east.
"We should make for Walberg," she insisted.
Sir Jonius is uncle's lackey," Art said.
"He saved us. We saved ourselves. I was 2 ticks away from running him through before he let us go and misled the king's defence."
That made Anise laugh.
"You might ride with perfect form, brother, but you don't exactly have the temperament for spilling blood. Then I would have handed my knife to you, and you could have done it. The point is, Jonius is not our keeper. And if we go east and he has a change of heart, the east will be flooded with uncle's men."
Anise hadn't thought of that.
"Then if not east or west, where shall we go?"
She closed her eyes, immediately thinking of her daydream about crossing Frozen Lake to the north, disappearing into the hinterlands forever.
"South, of course," Arch said, snapping her eyes open. "South? But the only thing south is
Gearhart and then Raiders Pass," Sir Dietrich finished. "Absolutely not. It's too dangerous. Your uncle's troops will be everywhere."
"They're not his troops. They're mine. And I will claim them."
"You don't understand what you're asking, Prince. I mean your Highness," Dietrich said. "I am from Gearhart, and I've been on the front lines at Raiders Pass. Ever since your father broke his marriage alliance with the West, there has been continuous bloodshed in the armpit of the Mournful Mountains. You do well to steer clear of the battle."
"Which is exactly why I can't," Art said.
"Your mother would have been proud."
Orm stepped through the pine branches and into the clearing. His armour was coated in a layer of snow, making him look more like a monster from the hinterlands than a knight of the Northern Realm.
"Welcome back," Dietrich said, frowning. "And Queen Lorraine instructed us to take them west to Blackstone. Would you defy her last wishes?"
The armoured knight reached across his body and grasped the arrow still protruding from his arm. With a grunt, he wrenched it out. Black droplets fell from the tip, and a thin river of dark blood drew a line through the snow stuck to his armour. Obviously the strange colouring was a trick of the light, but still it gave Anise the creeps.
"Her last wish was that her son shall be king. That's exactly what he's doing."
"Thank you," Art said.
"Then I command Sir Dietrich to escort me to Raiders Pass."
"As you wish, my king," Dietrich said. "But I shall do so under protest."
"Noted. And you, Sir Armoured Knight, I command you to protect my sister as you travel west to Blackstone. She'll be safest there."
"What?"
Anise exclaimed.
"No! I'm going south with you. We're going together."
"I am the king, and you will do as I command."
Arch stood, stepping into his boots and pulling his cloak tight around his shoulders. Anise gained her feet just as quickly.
"I am your elder sister, and we will be separated over my dead body."
Arch laughed, and the sound grated on Anise's nerves.
"Don't be so dramatic. You are my sister, and I love you," he said. "May we meet again when the kingdom is ours once more. Travel safely."
With that, he turned and marched away, motioning to Sir Dietrich. Anise gawked at him, but then pulled on her own boots and started to follow. He could make commands all he wanted, but he couldn't actually stop her. Unfortunately, the armoured knight could. Still bleeding profusely, he stepped in front of her, blocking her path.
get out of my hell-frozen way?
Anise demanded.
Sorry, my lady, Arm rumbled. I can't do that.
You can, and you will.
When he didn't move, Anise dashed to the right, slapping at the knight's arm as he lunged for her. He was too strong, wrapping her up and tackling her to the blanket of pine nettles.
"Release me!"
Anise shrieked, pounding on his helmet, his chest. When he still didn't unhand her, she shoved a finger between his armour where the blood was trickling out. He grunted in pain, but his grip didn't diminish. She swiveled her head around, searching for Arch, but he was gone. Her brother had left her with the most dangerous knight in the realm. The man who'd killed her mother loomed over her, closing his gloved fingers around her neck. Part 2. Greece, Bane, Rhea, Rhone, Anise. The death mark is the most misunderstood of all the marks, for it brings not death, but life. The Western Oracle. 8. The Western Kingdom, Night's End, Greece Jolly. The rising sun seemed to set the waters of the Bay of Bounty ablaze, chasing away the shadows of night. At the bay's widest point, Greece Jolly could just make out the ramparts of Bethany, and beyond, the fang-like peaks of the western edge of the Mournful Mountains. On the opposite side of the bay's mouth was a wall of spiked sentinels, piercing the sky like massive spearheads. Rising behind them were the numerous towers of Blackstone, stone behemoths that were as much a symbol of the strength of the Northern Kingdom as the golden, cracked but never broken shield printed on their banners. Not that Greece gave two dung heaps about the north. All he cared about right now was getting out of the stocks, so he wouldn't be late for his royal rendezvous. After he'd been caught thieving two lousy loaves of bread from the baker, he'd been clamped in the wooden stockades by a power-hungry city guardsman, who clearly had at least two sticks shoved between the cheeks of his buttocks. Greece knew he hadn't helped his cause by spitting in the arrogant fellow's face, but the guy had it coming to him. Then again, staring out across the crystalline waters of Bounty, with Night's End behind him, Greece could think of plenty of worse places to be stuck in the stocks. Not that he was staying. Although his legs were starting to cramp and his back felt as crooked as a question mark, Greece couldn't help but grin at the scheme he'd concocted months ago in the event he ever got caught stealing. Right on time, Silent Billy appeared. The kid was supposedly 14, but was so small and skinny he might have been 11. He was also extremely nimble and flexible. He'd helped Greece with several tricky jobs already. The boy claimed surviving the stockades would be a snap of the fingers for someone like him. "Did my man give you your coin?" Greece asked. Silent Billy nodded. Greece sighed in relief. Relying on another street rat to handle the money had been the riskiest part of the deal. He'd purposely included extra coin, just in case Brawny Johnny skimmed any off the top. Not that Greece would blame the meathead if he did. He'd have done the same thing. "And the city guardsman?" Greece asked, holding his breath. Bribing a guardsman wasn't the most difficult task, but you never knew when one of them would suddenly turn righteous. Night's End was nicknamed the Holy City, after all. Luckily, this wasn't one of those times. Silent Billy scrounged around in his pocket and produced a key. Greece let out a soft whoop as Silent Billy unlocked the stockades. Having all his savings go toward his escape sucked goose eggs, but it was better than the alternative. Plus, he was always one scheme away from getting rich. Billy's scrawny arms struggled to push the heavy top half of the stocks off of Greece, but he eventually got the job done, the wooden planks thudding to the side. Greece stood up slowly, feeling his joints pop and his muscles scream at their newfound freedom. He massaged his shoulders and neck for a few minutes, and then said, "Get in." The boy looked ready to run, so Greece grabbed him by the scruff and shoved him into the stocks. "A deal's a deal," he said, closing the upper half and relocking it in place. They couldn't leave the stocks empty, or the entire gig would be up.
The guard he bribed for the key would face accusations, and he would most certainly point the proverbial finger at Greece, who would then face more than just a few days in the stockades.
"Hey, urchin,"
a withered old man hissed from down the line.
"Get me out of here."
Greece laughed, pocketed the key, and whistled a tune as he walked away from Silent Billy and the other poor souls stuck in the stockades. He had a date, and he wasn't about to miss it. He traipsed along the streets outside the walls of the castle, watching the city start to come alive with beggars and barterers, monks and crooks, men wearing long robes and longer beards, and women dressed in chaste frocks, so large and frumpy they appeared as shapeless as men. For the most part, they wore all white, the colour of purity, occasionally trimmed with light blue or green thread. By law, they were all devoted followers of Roth, their deity. From what Greece had seen in the 3 years that he'd been here, Roth was a very mean-spirited god, his righteous anger meted out by the three Furies and their holy army of Furia. Although he'd never utter it aloud, Greece thought Roth was created by the royals as a way of governing by fear. Gods, he hated this city. If he had to choose a deity, he would prefer the varied gods of the south. Not that he was religious. At the moment, his only religion involved worshipping the fairest maiden he'd ever laid eyes on. If not for her, he would have left already, off to find his fortune somewhere else, dragging his sister behind him. His stomach growling, he snatched a plum and two pears off a vendor's cart as he passed, his fingers so quick that the seller was none the wiser. Yes, Greece Jolly was in top form today. He munched on the pears as he walked, saving the plum for the girl he was meeting. She'd be delighted, and that would surely earn him a kiss at the least. He'd tell her the plum was stolen, which would only excite her the more. He knew he was risking his life meeting her. If her father ever found out, Greece's execution would likely be slow and painful, but that just made her more appealing. He couldn't help it. He thrived on risk and adrenaline, which were his drugs of choice in the city where getting a drink meant a long pull of rose or lemon-flavoured water. Greece skirted the southern edge of the castle wall. When he finished eating the pears, he smashed their cores on the stone. The wall came to a 90-degree angle, and then shot northward. All in all, the castle walls formed a perfect square, a thick, impenetrable barrier to attack from all sides. But Greece didn't care about that, because he wasn't meeting the princess within the castle walls. Instead, he hung a left and moved swiftly along the western coastline, the ocean still dark blue, the rising sun blocked by the walls of Night's End. Somewhere in the distance, Greece could make out the shape of a Crimean merchant vessel, heading for the Bay of Bounty. He wondered whether the ship was looking to sail to the north or the west, and whether there would be a battle over their goods. More and more, the bay had become a war zone, as the dueling kingdoms sought to control the largest shipping port in the realm. Greece also wondered whether the Crimeans would ever tire of having their ships sink to the bottom of the harbour. Probably not, he thought. Not as long as there was coin to be had. Greece knew that at the core of all humans was a greed for wealth and power that could never be fully sated. As he approached the entrance to the cryptlands, Greece shined the skin of the plum on the bottom of his shirt. When he heard voices, he darted behind the wall of one of the tombs, pausing to listen. "You've heard the rumours from the north," a familiar voice said. It was Sir Barrow, a round-faced lamb-chop of a guard who accompanied the princess everywhere she went.
"I give no credence to rumours," a second voice said. "Damn, Sir Cray."
He was a nasty old knight, with eyes like a hawk and ears like a royal hunting hound. Greece knew he'd have to be extra cautious today.
"But you've heard them," Barrow said. "They're official streams, you know."
"Yes, I've heard them. But official or not, they're still rumours."
"Even the most outlandish of rumours hold a glimmer of the truth," Barrow said.
Instead of sounding wise, like he surely intended, he came off like a child reciting a line taught by his tutor.
"Not this one," Cray said.
"Then how do you explain it?" The Dread King was killed, not by poison or arrow, but by falling down the largest staircase in the kingdom. Greece already knew all of this. Everyone had heard about the Northern King's untimely demise. But Barrow wasn't done speaking. Some are saying it was his own shadow that killed him. Now, that was a rumour Greece hadn't heard.
Absurd, Cray replied. The so-called Dread King was probably drunk on his own power and tripped of his own volition.
There's been talk of the start of the King's plague, Barrow said, not backing down. We're being told to be especially vigilant.
The King's plague is the equivalent of the contents of my chamber pot,
Cray said crudely.
One king's death means nothing.
One out of eight, Barrow said. Not to mention all the guards who have been dying.
Coincidence, Cray said. Nothing more. You should know better than to talk of fairy tale prophecies by a woman who was naught but a witch.
Greece almost laughed, but managed to clamp a hand over his mouth. Sometimes the Westerners were so stupid, he wondered how they'd risen to power in the first place. More than 100 years had passed since the Western Oracle's prophecy about the one who would come bearing the death mark, ushering in the king's plague, a time when the four kingdoms would be torn apart by the death of 8 kings. Despite the efforts of several generations of kings to stamp out talk of the Oracle altogether, there were still fools like Barrow who spoke of her from time to time. Just because a stupid king fell down the steps of his stupidly high tower and broke his own stupid royal neck didn't mean rot. Greece had also heard about how a castle knight had died each day for the past week, but Cray was right. It was nothing more than coincidence. Each death had been the result of an accident. One knight fell from his post on the castle walls, probably because he'd been craning to look down a peasant girl's billowy frock. Another had choked on a large chunk of beef in his stew. He was obviously eating too fast. And on and on. Greece shook his head and climbed the wall silently, ignoring the rest of the knight's pointless argument. Atop the crypt, Greece stayed low, scanning the holy burial grounds. Various stone structures, the crypts, dotted the landscape, each protected by a large grey tree, planted to mark where the dead lay. The Furia claimed the bigger and stronger the trees grew, the more secure the position of the deceased in the afterlife. After all, it was most everyone's goal to one day reach the 7th heaven and look upon Roth's face. But not Greece. He knew that trees were just trees. His heart did a little jig when he spotted the princess in her usual location, within the walls of her family's crypt. She came once a week to mourn the dead, which meant, of course, to meet Greece. This was their 6th such meeting, not that Greece was counting. Her father, King Gil Loren, probably thought she was the perfect daughter, as holy and pure as the Furia themselves. If he only knew her secrets, he'd lock her away and melt the key into a puddle of liquid ore. And then he'd rip Greece's head from his neck with his bare hands and mount it on the wall. He swallowed and turned his mind to more pleasant thoughts. Greece remembered the first time he'd laid eyes on the princess. Her sun-dusted hair plaited into a crown on her head, her lips naturally curled into a mischievous smile. She'd been slumming with her guards in the commoner marketplace. Later she confided in Greece that her father only went for it because she'd sold it as an act of charity to the commoners, spending her gold on their fruit and wares. Rhea bought a chaste green dress from a sprightly woman with tiny fingers. The woman looked shocked at the weight of the bag of gold the princess had placed in her hands as payment. Greece had been enchanted by the princess's grace, by her smile, by the way she'd conversed with the commoners so easily, as if she was one of them. He'd followed her through the marketplace as she moved from stall to stall. He swore she looked at him several times, always wearing her sly smile. He tried winking at her, and to his surprise, she winked back. Something about her was different than the other royals he'd seen, who always came across as pompous, looking down on the common sinners like wrath from above. Rhea, however, had seemed human.
That's when something had happened that almost made Greece a believer in fate. Despite the gang of castle thugs protecting Rhea, a real thug managed to slip between them and grab the princess. His eyes were fully dilated, and he had a desperate look about him, a wildness that reeked of a life of bad luck and poor decisions. Before Greece could blink, the man had a knife to the princess's throat, and he was demanding gold in exchange for her life. An impossible trade, considering the man wouldn't get more than a few steps away with his gold before being cut down, but he wasn't thinking clearly. In any event, the castle guards had been wary of getting too close to him, for fear the man would do something drastic. But Greece was a shadow when he wanted to be. He'd slipped amongst the merchant tents, creeping closer, until he was behind the man. The man had already been given 3 sacks of gold, tossed at his feet by the guards, but he was demanding more. They didn't have any more on hand. Greece could see the man's white-knuckled hand clutching the handle of the knife. He could sense time running out, like sand slipping through an hourglass. And he moved with the speed of a well-practiced thief, except this time it wouldn't be food he was stealing, but the princess's life from her abductor. He'd yanked the man's arm back, twisting it so hard he'd dropped the knife. Then Greece had slammed his fist into the man's face. He'd dropped like a sack of rice, his body all floppy. The guards had hauled him away and stepped between Greece and Rhea. But he had still been able to see her eyes, her slightly parted lips, so full and pink, like blooming flower petals. The way she looked at him, with surprise and a sliver of excitement. And maybe a touch of fear, too.
"Thank you," she'd said. "You very well may have saved my life. Your valour has earned you a just reward."
She'd quickly scrawled a note and handed it to one of her guards, who handed it to Greece. She said,
"Present this at the castle gates to claim your reward. You will not be disappointed. May Roth bless you and your family."
There was something sly about the smile she gave him before mounting her horse and riding away, back toward the castle. Greece had waited until she was out of sight, before opening the folded note and reading it.
"Crypts, sunrise," it read. "Don't let anyone see you arrive."
He'd smiled from ear to ear. Just reward indeed, he'd thought. The princess is full of surprises. They'd been meeting in the cryptlands once a week ever since. Now, on the whisper-quiet feet of a natural-born thief, Greece tiptoed along the wall, circling behind her. The tree she stood under was a behemoth, its grey branches as thick around as stone columns, clear evidence that the dead had already ascended to the 7th heaven. Buried beneath the tree were generations of Lorenz and their allied counterparts, House Thorn. Here lay Rhea's grandfathers, King Ennis Loren and Lord Grant Thorn, her grandmother, Gertrude Thorn, her uncle Ty Loren, a sackcloth that represented her eldest brother, who had vanished mysteriously as a boy and was never seen again, and her mother, the controversial Queen Cecilia Thorn Loren, who took her own life shortly after giving birth to twins, Rhea's younger siblings, Bea and Leo. Rhea looked radiant in her night-dark dress of mourning, which hugged her vivacious curves from hip to waist to breast. The thick, shapeless frock she'd surely worn when she left the castle lay in a heap on the ground. Greece dropped silently behind her, grinning to himself. He swept in from the back, grabbing her around the waist and scooping her up. She gasped, but when he swung her around, a smile crept onto her pink lips.
"How do you do that?" she asked,
staring at him in fascination. Greece was loath to release the princess's hips, but he did so he could produce the plum. "The same way I nicked this gift," he said, "with skill." She managed to stifle a laugh with her hand, else their stealth meeting be discovered by her protectors guarding the outside of the crypt. Princess Rhea accepted the fruit and took a big bite, juice dribbling down her chin.
"Gods," Greece thought. "She can make anything look good."
She handed the plum back to him, and he took his own bite, wiping away the juice with the back of his hand. Rhea stepped closer, and his heart palpitated.
Don't you feel bad for whomever you stole that from? She purred. Grease could feel her hot breath on his. It smelled of peppermint tea.